Exobe 38 this morning. But this is the beginning of, from what I can figure out, the heaviest speaking schedule that Reasons to Believe has ever undertaken, especially the next 6 months. And we're going to be sending out all four of our staff scholars. Dave Rogstad is going out on the road too. He's our kind of our scholar administrator, but people are wanting him to come speak as well. So it'll be Ken Samples, Fuzz Rana, Dave, and myself, and we're all going in different directions. And I think what we're seeing is kind of a breakthrough for our organization in that major churches for the first time are willing to touch us with a 10-foot pole. So that's been good. So it won't be just limited to this church. So, and I took a short trip just this past week and went out to speak at Rice University. But first thing I did there is I did some programs for the Sunlight radio show. It's a syndicated radio show, 5 minutes of sunlight. So I had to do three 5-minute interviews, and that's a challenge. They'll be airing in February and March. And the interviews focused on my personal testimony, what Reasons to Believe is all about, and then the Origins of Life book. And I think what made it particularly interesting is the host is a fairly ardent young earth creationist. In fact, he was Henry Morris's student. So, but he was willing to let me speak, and he says he won't edit out too much of the stuff that disagrees with his views, so we'll see. And then I had a lunch at the faculty club where I just fielded questions from Christian faculty and students. And then spent the afternoon with a gentleman by the name of Rick Smalley. And some Christian faculty have been trying to witness to him. If you don't know him, he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on nanotubes and nanotechnology. And for the first time in his life, he's actually willing to entertain some discussions on the Christian faith. And there was a guy in his department, he's a full professor, Jim Tour, also a nanotechnologist, and a Jew, and a very ardent student of the Bible. He told me he'd read through the entire Bible over 20 times. But we got to talking about Bible reading and Bible study. Because he said, you know, I've had a meeting with Rick Smalley already and just couldn't answer his questions. And so I had my meeting with him. It lasted a couple of hours. And, you know, the questions are the kind of things we talk about in class here all the time and things that we equip our volunteers. And I said, you know, we could have probably got somebody from our Houston chapter to talk to him. On the other hand, I do think it was important that Rick got to talk to a scientist. And he really wanted to talk to someone in the hard sciences, so it was a very good meeting. And he wound up coming to the campus lecture that evening. And the campus lecture focused on a lot of the questions he was asking. So, you know, we didn't have that much time, and he was really overjoyed to discover the questions we didn't get to discuss were the topic for that evening. And so we had the largest lecture hall at Rice University, which is 250 seats. That's the largest hall they've got. It's kind of a campus like Caltech. They only have 4,000 students and lots of faculty. But we had 350 squish into that room. So the students just filled the aisles, and they were standing at the back. And, you know, as is typical, we have a Q&A session that's about three times the length of the talk. And all those students standing in the back, they stood there until, you know, we started at 7 o'clock. And we wound down the formal Q&A time about 10:30, and then there was another half hour of informal Q&A. But I was amazed at how the room just remained filled for that time. But Rick Smalley asked some great questions on the physics of time and how that relates to sin. So, and that was a real eye-opener for the rest of the students there, and a lot of people just thanked him for raising the question. And my own feeling is that this guy is on his way to becoming a Christian. And I think the real breakthrough was, we were kind of discussing this in the afternoon, because his style is that, you know, he just uses his great intellect to go into a subject and get it all cased in 6 months or less. And I thought, well, this is what I'll do with the Christian faith. But he now realizes this isn't going to happen. It's going to take a lifetime. And, you know, this guy, Jim Tour, has been trying to communicate to them, you know, Christianity isn't a 6-month project. So, yeah, and, you know, he's a guy who's been reading through the Bible 20 times over. But one thing that did make me sad is that, you know, these are the kinds of questions that not just Nobel laureates ask, and the Christians really need to be equipped to deal with it. He was much more interested in talking about the future than the past. He says, all these Christians come to me, and they talk about the evidences for God and creation. And he says, well, you know, I'm a nanotechnologist. I see that all the time. But what I really want to talk to Christians about is, what's God's plans for the future? What are his plans for me? I mean, those are great opening questions to talk about the Christian faith. But it was a bit sad for me to discern that he just wasn't getting answers from the Christians in his life. As, you know, what's the purpose of the universe? What's the purpose of humanity? Why are we here? Why all these stars? Those kinds of questions. That I sometimes think we just assume, well, everybody knows that kind of stuff, but evidently that's not the case. So I had to make a quick trip to South Bend because I was doing some television interviews there. So I actually went from here in the Pasadena area to Houston, then to South Bend, then back home. And it's my first time in South Bend, and I discovered it's a football city. So I was coming up to my hotel. The main street was just filled with people holding up signs, I need tickets. And you know, you see hundreds of people trying to get tickets for the game. So, that sense, I'm glad that Notre Dame won the game. But, you know, I was there like, you know, 2 days before the game. But the other thing I discovered is all the hotels double their prices every time there's a game being played in town. So, but the Harvest Show is a new television network that's been developed, and it's not just here in the U.S. They have about 15 to 20 television stations here in the U.S. They're up on DirecTV, so most people get them through the satellite. But their primary thing is they air programming into the Far East and the Middle East. And so we did two interviews, and the first one had to do with what's reasons to believe, and you know, please tell us about this testable creation model. And the hosts were very intrigued about our new approach for reaching people through a falsifiable, testable, predictive creation model. Then the second interview, which was taped, the first interview was live, and the second interview was taped for future broadcasts, was on the book A Matter of Days. And I was interviewed by the son of the founder. The founder is a pastor, and the son is also a pastor. And then I was interviewed by a gal who's a former Miss America, but has been interviewing personalities for about 20 years. She had read my book. The pastor had not read my book, but he went to my website. And they said, you know, please don't get offended. That's how we were assigned. She was supposed to read the book. I was supposed to go to the website. But what he discovered was that he thought this would be the easier task. And he was not able to get through the website. And he says, how deep does that website go anyway? I said, well, if you spend 24 hours a day on it, you might be able to get through it in 2 weeks. Just to read everything that's there. So... Well, that's if you eliminate all the archived radio and TV and webcast shows. If you eliminate that, that's about how much time it'll take you. And, of course, then we got portions of the website are kind of like a members-only thing. You have to get a registration, which is free. And he hadn't bothered to go into that, but he said, you know, I have to confess, only got into a tiny part of it. But the gal was able to read through the whole book, so we had a good interview. And she was already in our camp. She said, you know, I've known for years now that biblical accounts of creation really do demand that it be long periods of time and not 24 hours. The other gentleman, the pastor, his father is a really ardent young earth creationist. And he says he's had a number of people come on the television show to promote the scientific evidence for a young earth view, and was rather astounded. He said, one thing I've picked up from your website is you don't go along with that stuff. And he said, you're a scientist, and what do you do with all this scientific proof for a young earth? And I said, well, you know, it's not proof. And he said, well, I've been taught all my life that there's this overwhelming scientific evidence for a young Earth view. And he said, would you mind if on the air I just hit you with one? And I said, fine, you know, let's pick up one. Well, the one he picked up, it was, you know, I was kind of embarrassed because, you know, he couldn't have picked a worse one from a young Earth perspective. But he told me afterwards he'd always been taught this was the best evidence to throw out. And it's the moon dust thing. So, you know, it's difficult because you always wind up kind of almost embarrassing the person who asked the question, because once you get the answer to it, you realize, boy, this is really dumb. And then he just said afterwards, I mean, is that true of these other? And I says, yes, it's true of everyone. He says, read the book. So that was a bit of a shock for him. But the former Miss America, she had it all cased already. You know, her problem is she's tall and blonde, blue eyes, and she says everybody figures that she's intellectually just really, really dumb. And she says, you know, I'm bright, I'm well-educated, but everybody treats me dumb. And she just thanked me afterwards for not treating her to be dumb. So I didn't realize that kind of stereotype goes around, but she says, oh, yeah, it's very, very much a problem for her, always has been. Let me tell you about a new scientific discovery before we get into Job. And this one has to do with galaxies. And it was published in, actually it's two papers that were published in the latest Astrophysical Journal. And they were both published in the same issue. You know, this sometimes happens in science, where two papers are published in the same issue and the two groups of researchers don't know one another, don't realize that their research discoveries actually interact. Because I read the references and neither group referred to the other group. So these are two independent papers that were published, and yet they highly relate. And the one I'm going to talk to you about first, it's a group of researchers who used the Hubble Space Telescope to look at globular clusters in five nearby spiral galaxies. Now, when you think of nearby, you might be thinking of the Andromeda Galaxy, or the one in Triangulum, M33 and M31. No, what they're referring to were spiral galaxies that are outside the local group, but nearest to the local group. In fact, we were up on top of Mount Wilson. Some of you might remember we looked at M51, the Pinwheel Galaxy. That's one of the five here that's listed. And so in terms of light years, they're looking at about 15 million light years away, as Andromeda is 2 million light years away. And the one in Triangulum is also about 2 million light years away. So these were five not-so-near spiral galaxies. But what they were investigating was whether or not, because the spiral galaxies they were looking at were somewhat similar in appearance to our spiral galaxies. And so they were looking at the globular clusters that orbit it. Maybe you don't know that term, but every spiral galaxy has a family of globular clusters that orbit around it. You say, great, what's a globular cluster? It's a very tight cluster of stars where the diameter of the cluster is typically about 10 light years across. And to give you some context, the nearest star to our sun is 4.25 light years away. So within this 10 light years, you have anywhere between 100,000 and 1,000,000 stars. So just stars jammed very tightly together. And our own Milky Way galaxy has 150 of these globular clusters orbiting around it. The Andromeda galaxy is about 250 of them going around it. The Andromeda galaxy is about twice as big as our galaxy. The Triangulum galaxy has got about 75. That's the one in M33. And then these other galaxies typically have about 100 each. But what these researchers were looking at was the condensation. Remember we were on the telescope, those of you up at Mount Wilson, what I did is I showed you a globular cluster that was highly condensed, and then a galaxy globular cluster was not so highly condensed, and I really wanted to show you one that was the least, or down at the other end of the spectrum, but the field of view is so small, we weren't able to get a decent look. It wouldn't have worked. We need a smaller telescope. Sometimes it's better to have a smaller telescope because you get a nice wide field of view and can see things you can't see in these gigantic telescopes. But it was some weeks ago I talked to you about a discovery how we can measure accurately the ages of these globular clusters by looking at how highly condensed they are. Because the older they get, the more the large stars tend to fall down towards the center. And so what these astronomers did is they looked at the condensation factor in each of these globular clusters, and then they measured the chemicals that are in the cluster, and they also measured the velocities of the individual stars. And when you do that, it gives you an accurate history of the merging events for that galaxy in the past. And one thing that was already known before this paper was published was that in terms of the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy, is that the characteristics of the family of globular clusters in both cases shows that our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy has not suffered a single major merger event since the disk was formed. And that would be like the last 12 billion years. For 12 billion years, the two large galaxies in the local group of galaxies has had a quiescent, in other words, no major merging events at all. And then they looked at these five other galaxies, and they discovered, with one exception, likewise, their globular cluster family shows that they have not had major merging events since the formation of the disk. Yes. A merging event is where a galaxy merges with another large galaxy, and the two come together. Okay, and that's the second paper that was published in the same issue. This paper is titled A Supernova Factory in the Merger System ART-299. And it's got this beautiful photo. Well, it doesn't look so beautiful when you look at the photocopy, but the original photograph in the journal, it shows these two large galaxies literally having a head-on collision. And when that happens, and this is the first time, this is the nearest merger system astronomers can see. And therefore, they were able to use powerful telescopes, not just optical telescopes, but in particular radio telescopes, to map in detail the supernova activity in this merger event. It's the first time astronomers have looked at two merging galaxies to measure precisely exactly what kind of supernova activity is going on. And then what they published here is that this merger hit a peak about 5 million years ago. So we're looking 5 million years after the main event. And even now we're seeing that the supernova rate's 1,000 times what it is in our galaxy. Okay, so our galaxy, we get a supernova eruption about once every 100 years. In this case, you're getting 10 a year taking place. And they said if we go back 5 million years, it's even more intense, because what the radio telescopes were able to pick up was the extended remnants from past supernova eruptions. Therefore, they were able to document that at the peak of the merger event, that it was much more intense than it is at the present rate of, 1,000 times what we have in our galaxy. The other thing they picked up on is that this merger event not only meant you had 1,000 times or 10,000 times more supernova eruptions per unit of time, but the supernova were much, much bigger than the ones we see in our own galaxy, which means they're going to be generating gamma ray bursts. Now, if you've been with the class for about a year ago, I talked about the consequences of a gamma ray burst. A gamma ray burst lasts only 10 to at most 90 seconds, but it's the most intense energy emission that our universe has experienced since the Big Bang. And if one of these, they call them hypernovae, which means a really, really big supernova, and when it goes through its supernova eruption, it will emit this gamma ray burst, and it basically sterilizes the entire galaxy, and some of the bigger ones can sterilize all kinds of galaxies in its vicinity. So you don't want these going on all the time. But in ARP-299, this is exactly what's taking place. And so these two papers were put side by side, and so the obvious the point you can draw from this, the fact that we haven't had any major merging events in our galaxy for 12 billion years is a good thing. We wouldn't be in the class today if indeed that kind of stuff was going on. And you say, well, wait a minute, there's only been life on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years. That's true. You definitely don't want anything of this nature happening during the past 3.8 billion years. But the truth of the matter is you don't want it happening any earlier than that either, because the merger event, and this is really what this paper is all about, not just the supernova factory that takes place, but just how it disturbs the dynamics of the universe, or of the two galaxies that are being merged, so that the spiral arms become completely disrupted and reform. If that were to happen in our galaxy any time in the past 12 billion years, we wouldn't have the spiral arm structure that would permit a star like the Sun and a planet like Earth to ever develop, and therefore there would never be life in the system. But it's also true that you don't want that going on in the Andromeda Galaxy or the Triangulum Galaxy. If either of those galaxies had one of these events taking place, they're near enough to ours that it would disturb the possibility of life on our galaxy as well. Now you say, how common are these merging events? Very common. As astronomers look out far away, we see that that's the norm. It's the norm for galaxies to be experiencing merger events. In fact, astronomers now realize that these large elliptical galaxies you see are the end products of merging events. And guess what? In terms of large galaxies, they are the dominant population. Over 90% of the large galaxies in the universe are these large elliptical galaxies. And so in terms of, you need a large galaxy for life, but most of them have had one of these merging events. So that means, from God's perspective, he needs to design the universe in such a way that the galaxy where he's going to put life does not have a major merging event, nor do the galaxies in the immediate vicinity have major merging events as well. And this is exactly the situation we observe. So next time you have Thanksgiving, you might want to thank the Lord for the lack of major merging events and the galaxies in our vicinity over the past 12 billion years. Yes. Well, not quite, because the universe is expanding, and therefore the galaxies were closer together in the deep past than they are today. So as we look far away, we see many more merging events than we look up close, because we're looking back in time to when these galaxies were closer together. And most of the large elliptical galaxies in the universe stopped producing stars billions of years ago, which meant that the merging events occurred early rather than late. This ARP-299 is a merging event that's happening now. But most of the merging events that did take place in the history of the universe took place like, 10 billion years ago, 5 to 10 billion years ago. Yes.
So how do we know that our own spiral galaxy couldn't have been the result of some very early merging
event? Well, we know that there were merging events taking before the formation of the disk, which leads to the spiral arm formation. That's what these papers say. They're ruling out any merging events after the formation of the thick galactic disk, which means the structure that sets up the spiral arms. So that means for the past 12 billion years, things have been quiet. For the first 2 billion, you actually need merging events to get a spiral galaxy. Without merging events, it's not going to happen. So this is actually more fine-tuning. You want merging events in the first 3 billion years or 2 billion years, but you don't want them after the first 2 billion years. Because if you don't get merging events early, you're not going to get this large spiral galaxy to start with. Yes. Okay. I meant now in terms of the context of a universe that's 13.7 billion years old. 5 million years ago, in the context of 13.7 billion, is now.
Oh.
Okay. Astronomically now, exactly. Anything within the past few million years, astronomers say, presently. And by the way, this merger is still going on. This merger events take several hundred million years to run their course. So it's only been going on it peaked about 5 million years ago, which means it probably started about 50 million years ago, hit a peak 5 million years ago, and it's going to still continue its merging probably for the next 200 million years. Because, you know, what we're seeing is that the original spiral arm structures of these two merging galaxies is still intact, but we know from looking at other merging events that it will be completely destroyed and will reform after that. The distance of ARP, let me see if it's, I hadn't photocopied the whole paper here. It's the closest merger event that we can observe, which means it's probably about 50 million light years away. Let me see if I got an actual figure here. No. It wouldn't be any more distance than the center of the Virgo supercluster. So. Well, yeah, that's the other thing. When astronomers give you time things, it's time relative to the time that we're taking the image. So, like, if it's 50 million years ago, relative to our time, the peak of the merger event took place 55 million years ago. But, you know, it could be anywhere from 30 to 50. So I got to read the rest of the paper to find out. And I didn't bring the whole paper. Yes. The question is, does the merger event affect the expansion of the universe? What affects the expansion of the universe is the total mass of the universe. And that total mass is constant. But as the universe expands, that mass gets more and more dispersed. So the galaxies get farther and farther apart, which weakens the effect of gravity to slow down the cosmic expansion. And so gravity would be powerful when the universe is young. It's weaker as the universe gets older and older. But the merger event itself would only affect the local velocity flow. And by the way, our galaxy will experience a major merging event in the future. But it's going to take place about 4.5 to 5 billion years in the future. As we look at the Andromeda galaxy and the Milky Way galaxy, we can tell that they're on their way to merging together. But it won't happen for another 4.5 billion years. Yes. Okay, the positive benefit of merging events is that the universe starts off with lots of big star clusters. So astronomers have actually taken their telescopes and looked far enough back in time where we don't see galaxies at all. All we see are these large star clusters. And then we can see these large star clusters begin to merge to form mini galaxies. And the mini galaxies merge to form large galaxies. And so in terms of how you get a spiral galaxy the size of the Milky Way, you need that sequence of merging events taking place when the universe is young. However, what is typical is once a large spiral galaxy forms, it begins to merge with other galaxies and becomes a bigger galaxy but loses its spiral structure in the process and becomes one of these giant elliptical galaxies. To give you kind of a picture, a giant elliptical galaxy is more like a sphere of stars where you might have, say, half a trillion stars within a particular volume. When you look at it through the telescope, it just looks like kind of a ball of just this dense mass of stars. And that will happen to any galaxy that loses its ability to form stars. So, for example, if our spiral galaxy were to stop forming stars within about 2 to 4 rotations, the spiral structure will collapse and the whole thing will become just this tight sphere of stars, which of course would make life impossible because the stars would be too close together, would disturb the orbit of a star like the Sun. So, and what sustains ongoing star formation is a spiral galaxy absorbing small galaxies. So as there's more fine-tuning. Not only must our galaxy be protected from major merging events for the past 12 billion years, it also must be provided with a steady diet of dwarf galaxies. As it sucks up dwarf galaxies in its vicinity, that's what continues to sustain fresh rounds of star formation, which sustains the spiral structure. And if that ever stops, then the thing collapses. So that's why there's so few spiral galaxies in the universe today. Only 6% of the galaxies are spiral galaxies. It's really difficult to sustain that spiral structure. A major merging event will destroy it, and if you don't get many merging events, it will also destroy it. And you want to make sure they're timed just right. And so that's one of the amazing things about our Milky Way galaxy, is that it's receiving this steady diet. And you say, well, how steady of a diet do you need? Well, about every 200 to 400 million years, you want to absorb a galaxy about the size of the Small Magellanic Cloud. So, and if you don't keep that up, then you're in trouble. Yes. Yes, we can look at what we do is we look at the globular clusters, and we can tell which ones were part of that absorption. And we can actually document the past 12 billion years of merging history for a galaxy. And yes, they've been amazed to discover it's almost regular. It's like every quarter of a billion years we pick up a fresh dwarf galaxy. Because, you know, by just normal physics, you'd expect you'll get a bunch in one time and hardly any for the rest. But it seems like it's almost a regular diet. So like, you know, 3 square meals a day, that's kind of what our galaxy is getting, rather than one big meal and then a couple of small meals. Yes.
The Bible talks about new heavens and that new strong system. You don't know the structure of the old universe, the new whole universe, the new lost physics and
Well, that was a question this Nobel laureate asked me. He said, you know, what's going to happen to this universe? And I said, well, you look at the end of the Bible, it says there will be no stars. This universe God spoke into existence. In the future, when evil no longer exists because God will have finally conquered it, then he will speak the universe out of existence and replace it with a brand new universe. And if you read the last two chapters, by the way, we'll eventually get to that creation account. That's the last creation account in the Bible, Revelation 21 and 22. But I'll give you a little bit of advance notice. It says there are no stars there. There's no sun. There's no stars. Why? Because we have not the need of the light of the sun, moon, and stars, because this is a new creation where God himself will be a source of light, and everything in it will emanate that light. So one of the things you can look forward to as you walk around a new creation, everybody you meet will be glowing with light. So, and there'll be no darkness, no shadows. Yes. Okay. Why do you have to live in a spiral galaxy? I think that's your basic question. Okay. Right, right. Okay. Yeah, what's really happening here, why it's so critical for life? Okay, you've got this spiral galaxy out there, and there's a dwarf galaxy that comes in its vicinity, and the gravity of the larger galaxy sucks it in. But the center of our galaxy is a heavy concentration of mass. About half the mass of our galaxy is in the central bulge. And so when one of these dwarf galaxies comes around, it's got a very high probability of being sucked into the core of our galaxy. Now, the way the spiral structure works is that if you get an infusion of gas coming into the core of our galaxy, the spiral structure will whip that gas out into the other parts of the galaxy. So what it does is distributes the raw material that comes into the core out along these spiral arms to form new stars. And it's the formation of stars along the arms that sustains the structure. In fact, I knew a fellow at the University of Toronto, and he would run models where he simply just stopped the star formation along the spiral arms, and the whole thing collapses in 2 or 3 rotations. But as long as you can get gas being whipped out into those spiral arms, you can sustain that spiral structure by just keep forming new. In fact, if you look at the spiral arms in our galaxy or any spiral galaxy, you'll notice it's marked by these big, hot, blue stars. That's a sign of recent star formation. Big, hot, blue stars can only burn for about 10 million years. And so when you see them, that means you've got fresh stars forming in that vicinity. The brightest star we see in the sky, Sirius, is in that category. It's one of those bright blue, young, hot stars. So, and yeah, if we wait long enough, it will go supernova, and we'll be in serious trouble when that happens, so to speak, right? So, and maybe that's why they call it Sirius, I don't know. Okay. Let's jump into the book of Job. Now, one of the things I shared with you last week is that, you know, this Job 38 we're going through, and this is actually our second study through the book of Job. Our first study was to go through Job 38 and to see how it reflects on the six creation days of Genesis 1 and how we can use the content of what it says about the 6 days to get a deeper understanding of the scientific details of Genesis 1 and settle all these fights that Christians have and non-Christians join in over what the Bible says about creation. It's the place to go to settle what the initial conditions of the earth really were that are described in Genesis 1, for example. But what we're doing now is going through it and realizing that predominantly this is a chapter where God asks questions to the 5 men that are assembled. You know, Job is 3 antagonists and Elihu are sitting here, and the Lord speaks to them. And he asks them 60 questions. And you say, where did I come up with a 60? You'll see that soon. And by the way, depending how you read the text, it could be anywhere from 55 to 65, approximately 60 questions that he asks. And what I mentioned last week, as we look in the context of these 60 questions, what the Lord is doing is exposing their ignorance about creation. And the context of these 5 men, they cannot answer a single one of these questions. And the significance of that is for the past 37 chapters, they've been wowing one another by how much they know about creation. And God says, well, you know some, but you don't know the really important stuff. And so he asks them all these questions. And Job's the first one to speak after God gets through the question. By the way, this is just part one of the tests. As you go to Job 39, he's got a bunch more questions. Job 40 and 41, several more questions he asks. And he gets through his four-part test. Job's the first to speak, and he says, you know, I know nothing. And yet these 5 men have had this debate going on about creation where they've been impressing one another with how much they know. But the point I was making last week is there's a strong apologetic argument here, namely that atheists and agnostics go around saying, you Christians, when you try to prove the existence of God and the reliability of the Bible, you're always appealing to the God of the gaps. And the whole point there is that Christians try to argue their case saying, look, here's something that you atheists don't understand. This is where God works. And the response of the atheist is, it's illegitimate to argue for the existence of God based on what we don't know. And the point I was making last week is that Job 38 actually legitimizes the God of the gaps argument if it's used the right way. I think the atheists have a case. It's illegitimate to go to something you don't know and understand and say, because we don't know and understand it, God must have done it with a miracle. It could be you've just been lazy as a scientist and haven't bothered to dig down deeply enough to see what's really going on. But I think the point that we can get out of Job 38, there are places where it's legitimate. Because the whole point here is God is exposing to these 5 men who have devoted their lives to studying creation, saying, you guys don't know any of this stuff. And the fact that you don't know it says something about me from the context of the Lord. And in that sense, I was arguing last week, this is a legitimate use. And the example I gave you, if you recall, was in origin of life research. For the past 40 years, our best biochemical labs have been trying to figure out the chemistry of the origin of life. And they've learned a lot. But they've learned a lot to realize that there are provable gaps that are not going to be overcome by pouring more research effort into the situation. And therefore, the simple challenge, hey, if you believe that life originates under natural conditions, then given the level of your biochemical research capability today, it should be trivial for you guys to make life in the lab. And the fact that you can't do it means that you need a supernatural creator to explain this. And I would argue that is a powerful point, because if we're talking a naturalistic pathway, then certainly we have the capability of duplicating that natural pathway. And if you read the Origins of Life book we got over there on the table, what we document is that every possible chemical pathway has been investigated and has shown dead ends. And probably the most dramatic dead end we talked about last week was just the problem of trying to put together the building blocks of the molecules, trying to get the amino acids to join together to make proteins, trying to join together the nucleotides to make DNA and RNA. And what I told you was that the limit they have found is 40. That we can put together 40 of the building blocks, but we can't get past the 40 barrier. And they've also noticed that as you go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, the effort that the chemist has to put into the design and the energy input for the experiment in order to get these things to assemble goes up exponentially. And what I mean by that is that the problem of getting two of these nucleotides to join together is one point, but if you want to put three together, you have to put about 10 times the control and the effort into the assembly than if you do with only two. Then when you go to four, it's 10 times the effort you need for three. And so you can see that you get an exponential curve here, and eventually you're looking at virtually infinite energy and design and control you got to put into the experiment to make things happen. And they've hit a wall at 40 where they say, hey, now we're at a point where it's just impossible for us to push much beyond. I would argue that surely that would be an argument for the God of the Bible being a necessary entry to get you up to the billions that you see in life. Somebody was trying to ask me, and you know, if you just take the human genome, 6 billion nucleotides are in the human genome. And we're struggling to put together 40 of these to make. And by the way, the RNA and the DNA pieces that they're making are non-functional pieces. All these researchers are trying to do is see if they can put them together, let alone put them together in a meaningful sequence. That hasn't even been attempted. So they just, let's do it easy. Let's just see if we can put it together. But that's an example. That's a very easy thing. And if there's a naturalistic pathway, there's got to be an easy way to pull all these things together. The fact that we can't do it does give us an appropriate application of the God of the Gaps. This is a gap that we would be able to fill if indeed it was naturalistic. And so I'm just saying, in terms of the whole case we're making here in Job 38, the questions that the Lord asks are basically in that context. If I'm not part of the equation, you guys should be able to answer this question. The fact that you can't answer this question means I'm the one that must be involved in doing this. So that's why I brought that point up last week, because if you go through the individual questions, everyone is in that context. If this is something that doesn't need the hand of God, you should be able to figure it out. And he's talking to scientists that are living 3,500 years ago, not scientists that are living today. So I want you to keep that in mind as we go through this. The other thing I didn't have a chance to bring up last week, again, that's just part of the introduction. Job 38 and 39, 40, and 41, we can put into the context of the command God gave to the human species in Genesis 1, 28 to 30. And maybe I'll just flip back there and read to you this command that the Lord gave to Adam and Eve. It says, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw what he made, and it was very good. Well, the point that we made when we were studying Genesis chapter 1 is God is giving a summary command to Adam and Eve that he expands in much greater detail in Genesis chapter 2, where he basically tells them, I've put you on the earth, and you're in charge of the planet, and your job is to manage the planet not only for your personal benefit, but for the benefit of all life that exists on the planet. For the benefit of all life, these are all things you should know. And these five men don't know these things. And as I've told you before, in terms of how well we do on this test, we can answer 9 out of the 60 questions. So even today, we don't know enough to really do the job. Now, of course, one reason why we don't know enough is because of what happened in Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve rebelled against God's authority and lost their relationship with him and lost their capacity to learn all these things. And I think what I'm seeing here in Job 38 is that if it wasn't for sin, God could have given us the instruction that we need to actually be able to manage the planet wisely. And you know, today we have all these Christian organizations that are starting, things like Creation Care, organizations that Christians are starting to kind of really get at the heart of Genesis 1, 28 to 30. But I think one of the things we've learned in this whole movement of better ecology is that if you don't know the complete picture of what's going on, you could really make some big mistakes. And indeed, that's been the history of the green movement for the past 50 years, is as we try to protect the environment and manage the planet wisely, because of our ignorance and because of our rebellion against God, we tend to make things worse. I mean, in one sense, the human species is a bit like a two-year-old that you send onto the backyard to do some gardening. Okay, you're probably better off keeping the two-year-old in the house and going out and doing the gardening yourself, because the two-year-old not being properly equipped, not having the appropriate knowledge, is likely in that context to do more harm than good. And even in the 21st century, we human beings are, you know, pretty well in the same spot. So in that sense, if you want to talk to your friends that are really into the green stuff, Job 38 is a good place to start. Well, you know, before we really take on this project, let's see if we really know the parameters that we're dealing with so that we don't make horrific mistakes and make things worse. Yeah. Well, let me give you an example from right here in the Los Angeles Basin. Okay. You can recall a few years ago, there was a concern about the kangaroo rat in San Bernardino and Riverside County. And so they put it on the protected species list. And, you know, where do these kangaroo rats tend to run around? Well, they like to run around the dirt in around the suburbia, because that's where they can pick up lots of food and stuff. And so what happened in Riverside and San Bernardino County is they passed a law that you could not clear the land around your homes. And so, you know, you couldn't, you know, clear the brush around your homes. You had to leave that there for the kangaroo rats. Well, then we had a forest fire, and the forest fire cleared that land for them, but in the process burned up all the kangaroo rats too, plus all the homes. So there's an example of a, you know, a good thought. You know, let's protect the kangaroo rat. Let's give the kangaroo rat a good chance. But in trying to protect the kangaroo rat, we wound up doing that rat more harm than we did good, and we harmed ourselves in the process. So now they've changed the law out there where you can clear the land around. You will kill a few kangaroo rats when you do that, but you are going to give them a better chance to survive if you don't allow these major forest fires to come through and just, you know, kill them outright. So, but sometimes you need to lose a few homes and a few rats before you figure these things out. And I think that, you know, as we go through Job 38, you're going to see that over and over again. Look, if we want to do a good job of managing the planet, we better understand this phenomenon more deeply than we understand it today. And, you know, what's frightening is here we are in the 21st century, and we're not doing a whole lot better than these five men in Job's time. So, and yet that command in Genesis 1 still stands. And in that sense, I think it gives us a deeper appreciation for, you know, what theologians call the noetic effects of the fall. And we rebelled against God in the Garden of Eden. It did serious damage to the way we think. And we wind up, because of a rebellion against God, drawing wrong conclusions as we look out at what's taking place in the world around us. And these noetic effects of the fall, as Ken Samples and our staff will point out, vary. They're less problematic in the mathematics classroom where you're trying to teach the students what 3 plus 3 is. The effects of the fall shouldn't affect your capacity to discern that 3 plus 3 is 6. However, in terms of, well, you know, how do we manage our families? The noetic effects of the fall could be quite serious because we're all trying to get our own way, and if you've got 6 people in the family all trying to get their own way, you're going to have some problems in your family. So, and in terms of science research, we would expect that the noetic effects of the fall would be most problematic in those research disciplines that are establishing the existence of God, and particularly the personal attributes of the Creator, namely that He is caring and loving, He is merciful and just. I mean, the text here and in the Psalms makes the point repeatedly, the heavens declare the righteousness of God. And, you know, when you talk about the evidence in creation for God's righteousness, you can expect that our fallen nature is going to get in the way of people being able to discern that. And because it gets in the way, we wind up mismanaging the resources of the planet. Okay? Okay, that's the double introduction. I tried to get all that in last week, but we weren't able to do that. But this is a really good passage to go to, just in terms of getting some sound apologetics principles. How can we use the Bible to share our faith with unbelievers? Well, the questions start off in the verse 4. And, you know, I've got a list here of questions we can answer and questions we cannot answer. And the first 5 questions, we can't answer. Question 6, we can answer. And when I say we can't answer, what I mean is we can't answer in complete enough fashion that we can wisely manage the resources for all life. We may understand parts of it, but not enough of it to be wise stewards of the planet. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Sure do you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footing set? Or who laid its cornerstone? I believe what this passage is really getting at is God's addressing these five men and saying, do you really understand how I made the earth? Now, in their context, they knew zip. They knew nothing. Today we know something, but this is still considered an unsolved problem in planetary physics. Exactly how did the earth take on its present form? How was it formed? We know a lot. We know, for example, that you need 3 supernova eruptions of 3 very different kinds in order to get all the elements in the planet that are necessary for advanced life. We do know that a Mars-sized planet collided with the Earth about 60 million years after the Earth was formed, and that set up the formation of the Moon and gave us some additional heavy metal enrichment. Those are the things we do know. But exactly how the solar nebula came to have the characteristics that it did, how it got to the location it did, one of the problems that astronomers are still trying to figure out is how did the necessary mix of heavy elements get to the solar nebula so early in the history of our galaxy? That's still a big mystery we're trying to figure out. And it's one of the reasons why we astronomers are convinced that in terms of the SETI project, where they say there's life everywhere in the galaxy, one thing that is a consensus among astronomers, we are the first upon the scene, just because of how enormously difficult it is to get the necessary heavy elements into a condensing gas cloud as early as 4.5 billion years ago. It's not difficult today. There's lots of places in our galaxy where we see gas clouds condensing, where you've got the mix of the heavy elements that you need. But to get it in the context of 4.5 billion years ago, that's really very difficult indeed, and we haven't got that figured out yet. Well, Wes, that's one of the unsolved problems. We know how big the collider is. We know its approximate composition. And we know the angle that it struck the Earth. It basically struck at a 45-degree angle. So it wasn't head-on. It wasn't grazing. A 45-degree angle. That's the stuff we know. But, you know, how did the solar system evolve in such a way as to produce this Mars-sized planet with an orbital path that would lead it to collide with the Earth? That's the unknown mystery. Because we look at the solar system today, all except the two smallest planets, Mercury and Pluto, have exceptionally stable circular orbits. And if you've got this Mars-sized body flitting around in the inner solar system, the big unsolved mystery is, why do we have such stable circular orbits for the rest of the planets if that kind of an event was taking place at that time in the history of the solar system? That's still an unsolved problem. So we don't know what the orbit of that we don't know the orbit of that Mars-sized body. We don't know where it formed. We've got a good model for how the present solar system bodies formed. This Mars thing is an anomaly, and one of the questions that's being debated is, were there other planets like that whizzing around in our inner solar system? We don't know. But we do know it happened. And we do know how big it was and what its composition was. And that, too, is a mystery. Because we actually have a fairly good understanding of the composition of the Mars-sized collider. But the big mystery is, how did it get that composition? Because the other inner solar system bodies don't have that composition. It's unique to the Mars-sized collider. But still an outstanding mystery. Well, the fact that it hit at a 45-degree angle with the Earth means that it had to have had a chaotic orbit. And if it had a highly chaotic orbit, then how did everything else stay so stable? So that's the question we astronomers are still trying to solve. And there is a concession in the astronomical community. This must be an exceptionally fine-tuned event. It looks like you've got everything exactly just right to pull it off without messing up other life-critical factors. So we're just beginning to get at all the miracles that are involved in this Mars-sized collider. So maybe in 30, 40 years we'll have some more information on it. But in terms of, can we answer this question that's here in the text, I have to say, no, we can't. Yes. Yeah, the question is, could it have been a moon that escaped another orbiting planet? Not likely. And the reason for that is that our models for how the satellites the planets form put a limit on the size of those planets, and the limit is about 1% of the size of the parent planet, which means that the biggest satellite that Jupiter has, Ganymede, is at the very top end of what you can get with these formation models. So it can't be any bigger than Ganymede. And the Ganymede is only slightly bigger than our moon. So it's not going to be anywhere close to the size of Mars. So that's why they refer to this as a planet. It's a planet that hit the Earth, not a rogue moon. But how did the planet form? Where did it come from? What was its orbital path? And how did it hit at a 45-degree angle without messing up other features of the solar system? That's stuff we don't know. Yeah. Yes, the Earth and the Moon do have different ages. The Moon is slightly younger than the Earth, which was one piece of evidence that astronomers used to discern this event. Because if the Earth and the Moon formed together, they should be the same age. They're not. If they form together, they should have the same composition. They do not. The composition of the moon is significantly lighter than it is of the Earth. And the first clue, actually, that astronomers had that something was up, and this happened when I was a graduate student 30 years ago, was the discovery that the Earth is the densest body in the solar system, and they measured its density, and they said it's too dense. A body this dense should not form. And so they're trying to figure out how did it get that very high density. And that's when they began to think about, well, maybe it received a collision. And maybe the collision was structured in such a way that there was a transfer of light material away from the Earth to the Moon, and a transfer of heavy material from the collider into the Earth. And indeed, that's kind of the story. And something that's really new to this is that, you know, when I was a graduate student, I was taught that the liquid core of the Earth was iron. There's now a new understanding that there's probably a uranium core in the Earth. And that really explains the features that we're now discovering about the dynamo of the Earth and why the dynamo of the Earth has been stable for 4 billion years, whereas the dynamos of the other planets burned out in just a few million years. Ours was sustained. And it also would explain why our planet apparently has enough uranium and thorium to sustain plate tectonics for 4.5 billion years. And so it's a whole new picture that we're getting. But then the question is, where did all that uranium come from? And so again, they're looking to the collider as maybe a source, but then how did the collider get all that uranium? So these are all problems that we're running into. Yes?
I have a question about a different collision with Earth. We have that probe that apparently crash-landed. That, according to the newspaper, Roger Wing's been close on that Venus project. And so I know that Roger's done stuff that we...
Right, right. Yeah, I didn't know that Rogers was part of that project. So
okay, if I could find out what authority is on that.
Sure, it's the same guy.
Well, I only know why Roger Williams went off to at Los Alamos and had a
podcast. Yeah. No, I don't know of another Roger Williams. It's probably that guy. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if he did an experiment on board the thing. Well, yeah, and there's a lot of good science coming out of that, because collecting that dust will tell you about events very early in the solar system's history. You know, they're hoping, for example, to go to the moon and see what that ancient dust has done. And some of what it does is that, you know, that solar radiation impacting the dust actually stirs up some chemistry that's of interest to people in origins of life research. Does a lot to destroy origin of life research scenarios as well, but that's kind of what they're trying to dig out. Because the problem with the Earth is you get this general erasure of what's going on about 3.5 billion years ago. I think we discussed here in the class that going to the moon is a great place to find out what was going on 3.8 billion years ago, because on the moon things have been undisturbed, whereas on the Earth that's not the case. Yes. Yeah, that's the question I had to answer on this harvest show. Well, you know,
they were dumb in their knowledge. You know, they were very
turned. It turned out to be not very deep. But had it been 10 times as deep, it would have been a deep trouble.
Well, let me give you a quick background. By the way, this is covered in the book A Matter of Days. If you want all the details, it's on the table there. And this is probably one of the more frequent arguments for a young earth. And so one of the things I shared with this guy, Dave Summerall, was that, you know, don't feel bad. This question is pervasive. Everybody thinks this is a powerful argument for a young earth. And it goes back to 1960. And it's a geophysicist by the name of Hans Pedersen who did an experiment on top of Mauna Kea before they put telescopes there. And what he did is he put up a filter 4 feet above the ground on top of Mauna Kea and had a little bucket underneath to collect the dust that was coming through the filter. And he says, if all that dust is cosmic dust, then if we do the calculations on the assumption that the moon is 4.25 billion years old, we should have between 200 and 300 feet of dust on the moon. And this could be a problem with this program that our government at the time was instituting. Let's send men to the moon. Because trying to land men on the moon where they're going to fall into a cloud of several hundred feet thickness of dust could be, catastrophic. Exactly. However, what Pedersen said, and by the way, Younger Creations immediately picked up on that and said, well, you know, if they don't find dust on the moon that deep, that will prove that the moon is very young, only thousands of years old instead of billions of years old. So, but Pedersen said in his paper that, my assumption that all the dust coming through the filter is most probably incorrect. And therefore, he used this paper to stimulate a research program that make dust samples with high-altitude balloons, and better yet, with satellites. Now, keep in mind, 1960, they've only had a couple of satellites go up. And so that was just really new stuff. He says this would be a worthy project for a future satellite mission. Go up and see what the dust is like. But he says, we don't have to wait. We can use a high-altitude balloon. Well, those experiments were done literally within 36 months after he published his paper and quickly showed that he was off by at least a factor of 1,100 times. So you take the 200 or 300 feet of dust and multiply it down, and then before they actually began to put stuff on the moon, there were scientists who said, well, let's do the calculations right. And they said, yes, there's dust falling on the moon, but there's also dust leaving. If you get a big rock hitting the moon, that will cause dust to be ejected from the moon. And it doesn't have to be that big of a rock. Actually, a rock about this big is quite adequate to eject stuff because of the moon's gravity being so much weaker. And then they pointed out there's also a second source of contribution. Ultraviolet radiation streaming in on the moon will break down the lunar crustal material and turn into dust. But they cranked all their numbers and wound up predicting that if indeed the moon is 4.25 billion years old, the total amount of dust that will have accumulated on the average over the surface of the moon would be about 60 millimeters thick. And so when the Apollo team began to land stuff on the moon, that's what they found, an average thickness of 60 millimeters. But to this day, young earth creationists are saying we've got proof that the moon is young because we don't find a lot of dust up there. But they haven't updated Hans Pedersen's initial calculations. So that's the big problem. And by the way, there's a second way you can figure it out long before Apollo went there, and that is to look at the craters on the moon. That's what I shared on this television show. I says, look, you know, regardless of what you think about the story, I'm saying we can observe craters on the moon. And the moon has a very small atmosphere, argon, and it rotates once every 29 days. This is a thin argon atmosphere where the planet is rotating once every 29 days will set up a very feeble wind, extremely feeble. They don't get hurricanes there. But that feeble wind over the course of billions of years will erode the oldest craters. And therefore, an independent way we can measure the age of the moon without using radiometric dating and without looking at dust, it's just simply observe the amount of erosion we see on the craters. In fact, you can look through a small telescope a small telescope is adequate to help you identify what are the brand new craters and what are the old craters. Because you can see with a small telescope that the new craters are hardly eroded at all, but the older ones do show a little bit of erosion. And when you measure that rate of erosion, what you discover are two things. Virtually all the craters on the moon are old. And those old craters were formed about 3.85 billion years ago, which is where they first got an inkling of this late heavy bombardment event of planet Earth. It was discovered by looking at the lunar craters and measuring the erosion rate. And so that gives you, you know, an independent check. We know the dust gives an accurate measure for the age of the moon because it's consistent with the erosion we see taking place on the moon. So, and you know, if you read the book A Matter of Days, you'll discover that every one of the young Earth arguments for science. I think that's about the second one I take on my list of going through, you know, is there scientific evidence for a young Earth? And what I did in that chapter is I gave you their 12 most frequently used arguments. You know, they got over 100, but I said, I haven't got time or space to talk about all 100, but I'll pick off their 12 big ones. And every one of their 12 big ones is in that same category. If you understand a property, it's an evidence for an old Earth, not a young Earth. But, you know, I felt bad for Dave Summerall because he was assuming, because of what he had heard in his dad's church, that scientists had no evidence for an old universe and they had overwhelming evidence for a young Earth. Well, a rule of thumb I just share with them, you know, before you believe that, it'd be good to check it out with your neighborhood scientist to see how credible that claim is. Now, that's just a good thing you can do, and you don't have to know any science to do that check. Okay, we're over time. Gee. Okay, next week I want to get to the question we can answer, okay? Who shut up the sea behind doors and it burst forth from the womb? We can answer that question. The next question, when I made the clouds his garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, we can answer part one of that question, but we can't answer part two. We'll get to that next week. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, Lord, we are grateful that we live in a day and an age when we can answer a few of the questions you gave to these men 3,500 years ago, but we acknowledge we can only answer a few. And the ones that we can't answer do powerfully testify of the need for you to be involved and to create and design this planet for a benefit so that we can survive. Lord, help us to measure the noetic effects of the fall, and we might appreciate how our fallen minds cause us to rebel against you, and in that rebellion we often overlook things that are in the record of nature that are staring out at us. And Lord, may we be reminded too that you commissioned us to manage this planet for the benefit of all life. And Lord, our motivation to study the record of nature falls short of what's necessary to accomplish that task. Lord, make us more submissive to you that we can understand these things that are out there to be understood. And Lord, I pray that you give us insight into this book and continue to give us new tools that we can use to share the love, life, and truth of you, the Creator, with people who don't yet know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.